Welcome to Whiskey Cask, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 178 for December 20th, 2008. Coming up in a few minutes...
You know, we can blend small parcels of very fine whiskey together to create a better overall product, like they do in the wine industry with, you know, some of the great wines, first grace from Bordeaux.
That's William Weems, who's taking his family's years of experience in the wine business and putting it to use with whiskey. More with William in a few minutes, along with part one of a two-part series on micro distillers. First, let's look at the news. After several years of waiting, Brooklady is unleashing the ultimate peat monster. The first bottling of Octomore is heading for retailers, and all 6,000 bottles have already been sold. Octomore is peated at a phenol level of 131 parts per million, which Brooklady claims is three times higher than any other whiskey on the market. By way of comparison, Laphroaig and Ardbeg peat levels are in the range of around 40 parts per million. Octomore was bottled at a cask strength 63.5% ABV. Brooklady's special bottling for this year's Isla Festival of Malt and Music was the quadruple distilled spirit. Even though it was still less than 3 years old and not able to legally be called Scotch whiskey. Now it's being called X4 and it's on the market as Brooklady New Spirit. And while it was distilled at 90% ABV, it's been cut to 50% strength for bottling. Like the Octomore, all 6,000 bottles are officially sold out at the distillery, but they'll be available at retailers while they last. Last time around, I mentioned the special e-cards that the Classic Malts folks were making available for the holiday season. Turns out the Glenlivet is doing the same for members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet Society. I've posted a link at the WhiskeyCast website. Here's something to share with your vodka-drinking friends. Looks like they're behind the times. A.C. Nielsen reports sales of whiskey and other brown spirits are outperforming the overall spirits category, with sales in the U.S. up 4.5% this year. 12 other countries are recording double-digit sales increases, including Russia, the Netherlands, Venezuela, Mexico, Poland, and Turkey. While other companies are pulling back on their sports sponsorships, that's not the case with distillers. Jim Beam has renewed its sponsorship of NASCAR driver Robbie Gordon for the 2009 Sprint Cup season, and Glengoyne has signed on to be the official whiskey sponsor of the World Fly Fishing Championships, which will be held next June in Scotland. Back in September, author and fellow malt maniac Ulf Buxrud told us about his new book on Japanese whiskies during episode 164 at Whiskey Live Paris. Now Ulf's been honored in the Gourmand World Cookbook Awards for the Best Spirits Book of the Year in his native Sweden. Japanese whiskey, Facts, Figures, and Taste will now compete for the world title against other spirits books from around the world. By the way, Ulf's book is available through the WhiskeyCast store powered by Amazon.com, along with his first book, Rare Malts, which won the Worldwide Award in 2006. Last August, James Espy and Tom Jago told us about their special blended scotch known as The Last Drop in episode 159. Now comes word that Jim Murray gave it one of his highest ratings ever. He scored it a 96.5 in the 2009 Whiskey Bible and also gave it all three of his annual awards for blended scotches, including the best new scotch blended whiskey. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. This time around, let's look at some of the major events during the first half of 2009 so you can make your travel plans in advance. The Victoria Whiskey Festival is January 23rd through the 25th in Victoria, British Columbia. Whiskey Live Tokyo is February 22nd, followed by Whiskey Live London February 27th and 28th. That same weekend is Dramfest 09 in Christchurch, New Zealand. The Whiskies of the World Expo in San Francisco is March 28th, followed by Whiskey Live New York March 30th and Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest Chicago on April 1st. The Spirit of Speyside Festival is May 1st through the 10th. The Spirit of Toronto Festival is May 8th, and the Isla Festival of Malt and Music is May 23rd through the 31st. If you have an event coming up during 2009, please email me, and I'll be glad to add the details to the calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask.
Hi there, my name's John Campbell, distillery manager at Laphroaig Distillery. Become a friend of Laphroaig. Claim your own square foot of Islay at laphroaig.com.
My interview with William Weems is coming up in a few minutes, but first, we've heard a lot about small batch whiskies, and there's a boom in so-called micro distillers in the U.S. and around the world. John Hansel of Malt Advocate magazine honored the U.S. micro distillers during last month's Malt Advocate Awards at Whiskey Fest New York.
The micro distilling in the United States is very reminiscent of the recent craft beer movement. The distillers are expressing the same passion, ambition, and creativity. We have been fortunate to already enjoy some of the early pioneers like Anchor, McCarthy's, AAA, and Charbet. This is just the beginning, my friends. In two or three decades, there will be enough new distilleries with mature stocks of whiskey to make the big distillers take notice. That's a lot of you. The current group of micro distillers in the United States are true pioneers, and we are proud to honor them collectively with their Pioneer of the Year Award for 2008.
John mentioned Anchor Brewing, the San Francisco brewery that's also home to Old Potrero rye whiskey, and proved that one doesn't have to be in Kentucky to make good whiskey. In fact, most of the micro distillers are located well outside the Bluegrass State, like Jess Graber, who distills Stranahan's Colorado whiskey in Denver.
It was kind of a lucky stroke that I'd been doing practical experiments on distilling for quite some time, about 35 years, and then came up with the idea that we could use a craft brew process to create a whiskey mash, and from then on the whole idea took off.
It seems like a lot of people are trying this craft brewing process and applying it to distilling now.
We're very flattered by that. We were glad to be the first ones.
And tell me how you guys sort of perfected this, because it seems like you guys have been able to come up with a whiskey that really works well at a very young age.
Well, what we did was the pattern of using a refined wash came after the great cognacs. The guys figured out a couple hundred years ago, rather than making our cognac out of the grape skins, let's make it out of some of the wines. It's just no one had applied that concept to whiskey. So once we figured out that we could do that, then we tried to build in flavor into it by using four different malted barleys in our mash bill, and then by accelerating the aging by using a heated and humidified warehouse so that the whiskey never actually sleeps during the wintertime. It continues to work. So we get a very rapid maturation of the whiskey.
Now, some would argue that the temperature cycling out in Colorado could be even more extreme than it is in Kentucky, which would accelerate the aging process even more, right?
Well, you can look at it that way, except that when things get really cold, your pores really close up, so does wood. So we have two temperatures. In the winter, we're at 68 degrees, and in the summer, our warehouse gets up to about 110. So we've got the two seasons. One is hot, and the other one is Hades.
And that gives it so you still get the fast aging, but it also gives it a unique flavor, too.
That the interaction with the wood is what gives it a whole lot. You're going to get 60% of your flavor from the wood. So having that happen maybe at a faster pace than normal is possibly adding some different flavors.
Now, a question that I don't think anybody's even thought about yet. Does aging whiskey at altitude affect evaporation in the Angel's Share?
Well, it does, except that by humidifying our warehouse, we don't lose the Angel's Share because we keep it humidified. We do believe that with high and low pressures moving in and out of the mountains, we get rapid changes in pressure, which pushes the whiskey in and out of the wood.
Which accelerates the aging process as well.
Yes. So a combination of that, of the humidity, the heat, and the high and low pressures, and we're getting a very, very good whiskey at considered to be a very young age.
How's the distribution going? Because I know it's hard for young whiskeys and new whiskeys to get into the market these days.
We've been very fortunate that there has been a lot of people, what we love to call the whiskey nerds out there in the world, who have heard about us, have locked on to us. And so by them requesting the product, we've been able to expand in over 30 states at this point.
Now, there once was a dram from Nantucket.
I won't finish that limerick, but there actually is a dram from Nantucket. It's called The Notch, and Jay Harmon makes it.
The Notch is basically a culmination of a brewery, winery, distillery. We started producing the single malt back in 2000. Essentially what we did was take Whale's Tail, which is our flagship beer, and run it through the brewery, do the fermentation, and then pass it off to the distillery. And then we do a double distillation in a small copper pot still. We bring the alcohol of the beer from 8% up to about 126, and then we cut it back and lay it into barrels for a minimum of 5 years. This first release was an eight-year-old, and it's a blend of eight different barrels, which range from Jack Daniels to Jim Beam to Woodford Reserve and most recently Buffalo Trace. We take those barrels, blend them together, and then we add a little bit of whiskey that we age in our French oak barrels that we held our Merlot in. The first bottles were distilled in 2000, released on August 8th, 2008, and it's blended at 88.8 proof. And most recently, Jim Murray came out, spoke, and actually launched our whiskey on the 8th and gave us a 92 in the Whiskey Bible and auctioned off our first bottle for $7,500.
Now, what's the goal here? What are you trying to accomplish since you're selling at the distillery only now, right?
Correct. We have a pretty captive market on Nantucket. And the idea was producing beer out of the brewery. Obviously, whiskey is beer that's been distilled. So we take the beer and distill it out. And the idea was that we could actually make products and distribute them locally without sending our beer further away from home. We could use the tank space in the brewery to produce a single malt. And really, the long-term goal for all the businesses is to become a single malt distillery. But obviously, you need deep pockets. So we have a full line of other products that will get us there. And we use a lot of, because we're a microbrewery and a micro distillery, we have a lot of equipment that crosses over from one business to the other. So fermentation tanks, mashing tanks in the brewery. Really the only thing that we had to purchase was the copper pot still and then set up the separate license. So really the long-term plan is to be a single malt distillery. We're actually retailing this at the distillery for $888 a bottle. We have a 200-person waiting list right now. When we first launched the product, we raised capital by selling futures and barrels of whiskey to private investors. So the investors would buy the barrel and it would sit in the warehouse. Back then, they paid about $15 a bottle for it, so they're pretty happy with their return right now.
That's one of the few investments that's actually made money this year. One of the hardest things about starting a micro distillery is trying to figure out how to make money while your whiskey is aging. Isla's Kilhoman Distillery did it by selling samples of its new make spirit, and a Wisconsin distiller is doing something similar. Brian Ellison runs Death's Door Spirits and sells what he calls a white whiskey.
Death's Door is actually a stretch of water between Washington Island and the Door Peninsula in Wisconsin, and we grow all of our grain that goes into our spirits on Washington Island. So Death's Door being the passage of water between the island and the mainland, all of our wheat has to go across by ferry, and so Death's Door seemed to be a good name for it, and frankly it was a little cheeky of a name as well for a spirits company, so we thought we wouldn't have any problems with liability from attorneys.
Now, you are doing something with whiskey that I've never seen anyone else try before. You're actually selling essentially new make or white dog as whiskey, right?
Yeah, well, we took the bad idea of Brown-Forman of their Frost 880 back in the day and brought it back. And we basically are doing a white whiskey. It's an aged product, 72 hours in a barrel and poured back out. So it's a very short amount of time touching oak. But the product itself has a wonderful flavor and nose to it. And because we're using all of our grain from the island, sweet, hard red winter wheat, it does have a great flavor to it that we were surprised as well. I mean, we were making the product originally to be putting in barrels, and now we save a portion of it to make into the white whiskey. And every batch that we've come out with now, we've done four batches of 360 bottles. Every batch is sold out in 3 days or less.
I tried some of this, and it's classic new make or white dog spirit. It's a little fruity. It's got the floral notes to it, and obviously none of the oaky or vanilla notes that the wood would add to it. It's just not in the wood long enough yet, but it's a very interesting spirit.
Well, thanks. It's one of those things that I always sort of say it's not a whiskey, but it's not a whiskey. And so we're finding a lot of people like it for mixing in cocktails, doing interesting. We've got mixologists in Chicago that are using it to sort of do some different experimental cocktails. And also a lot of people, frankly, that just like it on with a cube of ice. It's sort of something lighter than an aged product. So it's a different thing altogether.
Where's it being sold?
We're in 4 states right now: Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Indiana. But starting December 1st, we'll be New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, as well as we're starting the West Coast after the first of the year with Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Utah, Montana, California, and then in the next 6 months, we're starting 20 other states. So we've got our hands full, and it's my biggest focus right now is getting the product in barrel for our age, because that's the stuff, frankly, we're the most excited about. But at the same time, a product like this is a fun one to make because it gets us attention and gets us a little something in the bank earlier than the aged product.
And you are trying to age the product too, right?
Yep, that's why we got the barrel right here. And we're using 7.5-gallon barrels, American oak. And right now we're putting away with an anticipated start date for our aged product this time next year.
I've posted links for these distillers at the WhiskeyCast website. Next time around, we'll go in depth with a micro distiller that's trying something completely different with his whiskey. We'll hear from Marko Karakasovich of Charbet in part 2 of the series on the next episode of WhiskeyCast. Scotland's Weems family has been a fixture in the area around Fife for generations. The family's land has supplied barley to distilleries for many years, but their business interests led them to winemaking, both in France and Australia. Now William Weems has come full circle with a line of malts that bears the family's name and Scottish heritage.
Well, we got into it really as a result of two things. Firstly, as you just alluded to, we've been in the premium drink sector primarily as winemakers in Western Australia and through a brand called Fonty's Pool, and in the South of France, Provence, through a brand called Rimeresque Cru Classé. And then the family have always had a passion for malt whiskey, and we thought we would translate that passion into a business. And the family estate in Fife has got sort of links going back to whiskey trade back to the turn of the 19th century, when Haig, their first distillery, is built on Weems land, and sort of barley even today is supplied from the estate into some of the leading distillers. So that's sort of where our sort of background in the industry came from. And we thought we saw a market opportunity in terms of actually all the complexities of the whiskey, of the Scotch business, in terms of the different type, terminology, single malt, battered malt, blended whiskey, to actually sort of make the proposition more readily understandable for the consumer in terms of identifying the whiskeys by their taste profiles and aromas. And that really idea came from the fact that we had an Australian winery and a French winery, and the confusing elements for even the knowledgeable consumer about the French appellation system and not having the great variety on the label. So we thought that the Scotch industry exhibited some of the same, had some of the same issues around it. So that's really the sort of background to it, Mark. From those two, from a sort of family perspective and from the sort of brand proposition perspective, you like. And if you then add, we teamed up with somebody called Charlie McLean. Do you know Charlie McLean?
Oh, of course.
Okay. Well, Charlie make sure that the liquid in our bottle is up to scratch, and he chairs our nosing panel. So to have somebody like his expertise as part of our business is great to have him on board, basically. We've been going for 3 years, just under 3 years. We've got 2 ranges, one being a single cask range, which isn't currently in the US, and the other trying to, again, bring our sort of blending experience in the wine industry to the fore to have a range of premium blended malts, but very much taking the philosophy, the approach, rather, that, you know, we can blend small parcels of very fine whiskey together to create a better overall product, like they do in the wine industry with, you know, some of the great, great wines first graced from Bordeaux.
Let's talk first about the blended malt series, because the labels you chose for these malts really sort of reflects the taste of the actual whiskey inside, right?
That's exactly right, yeah. That's the sort of premise to the brand, to make it more understandable for the consumer. Now, they're very different. I mean, there are other people, other brands, you know, like Compass Box, looking to do a similar thing, and I, you know, from that perspective, I think it's good because it'll grow, hopefully, the overall market.
Let's go through the individual whiskies in that portfolio. You start with, I believe, the Spice King, right?
Well, in terms of all three at the moment, so Smooth Gentleman, Peat Chimney, and Spice King, they are all the same base blend, which is an eight-year-old malt. And then the individual taste profiles, if you like, so the spicy, the peaty, and the smooth, comes from different attributes, either from the wood itself or from the specific distillery. It's how the taste profiles are arrived at. So typically what we do is we would determine, you know, what sort of whiskey we're looking to create and then work the taste profile back from there. So, for example, the smooth is a predominance of American oak, gives it that taste profile. The peaty, as you probably guessed, Mark, is a predominance of Islay whiskies.
And how did you get the Spice King?
And the Spice has input from a very well, I prefer this wasn't written down, actually, but is a predominance of which is noted for its spiciness.
So if you want to find another way to word that.
Okay, well, if I just say then the spiciness is made up of the same 8-year-old base blend and then a well-known distillery off the west coast of Scotland.
Which people noted, can draw their own impressions from that.
Which is noted for its spiciness. Maybe that's the way to get around it.
That would work, I think.
But actually, one of the good things is it sort of creates a discussion point as well in terms, particularly the single cask level, in terms of you know, connoisseurs saying, well, which distillery is this from? You know, and then that from time to time generates a bit of debate around that point.
And on the single casks, I had the chance to taste some of your whiskeys in Paris during Whiskey Live Paris. The chocolate one was a very interesting one.
Yes, that I think is chocolate heaven, which I think from memory, we have a number of single casks out on offer at the moment, is a Speyside. Yes, I think that is an interesting taste profile. That was really the sort of selection of the name was chosen basically by Charlie on the back of his tasting notes. So it had sort of chocolate, Charlie felt it had sort of chocolate overtones and certainly also a bit of sort of spicy chocolate on the nose. So that's the sort of, that's where that one came from.
What are the other single casks in the range?
Well, the other single casks in the range at the moment we've got on release are one called Sea Smoke, which again is a single Islay cask which we've selected with Charlie. And that again is got that sort of sea, sort of smoky aroma that you would get in some of those Islay whiskey, slightly less peaty than you would take for a normal Islay whiskey. We've got another Islay single cask out at the moment, but which isn't on release in America yet, called Bonfires of the Beach, which again is quite typical of Islay whiskies. And then jumping across to the mainland, we've got a number of Speyside and a few Highland casks on offer. But obviously, given the very nature of the fact that they're single casks, you know, the supply is pretty restricted in terms of each of these casks.
Where are the single casks available?
Which markets? At the moment, they are the markets that the single casks are in the UK. France is quite a big market for us. Spain, Italy, and then hopefully 2009 we'll see the launch of the single cask range in America.
And where else do you plan to start distributing the whiskies?
Well, in fact, this morning we just got our first order in from China, which is quite exciting given we're quite a young company. So we're looking at some distribution options in the Far East at the moment. And also in terms of support, you know, having a winery in Western Australia, parts of the Far East are nearer Australia than Sydney is to Perth. So it makes it pretty helpful in that respect.
Now, one of the things I've heard from a number of the independent bottlers over the last couple years or so is that the boom in whiskey worldwide has really sort of dried up the supply of casks that are available to independents. How hard was it for you to source yours?
Well, I think that is a very good question. I think supply is definitely tighter than it was when we started 3 years ago. It's not easy, but what we're trying to do now is, you know, we've got a stock of single casks now that we've managed to build up that we were lucky enough to secure last year, and we are now having identified good casks in terms of the wood itself, trying to recycle some of these casks and perhaps look at filling some new make spirit to sort of take destiny into our own hands, as it were. So I think, you know, I think certainly in the short term, supply won't get any easier. But thankfully, you know, we've got pretty good relationships within the industry with Charlie and also through a chap called Alan Rutherford, who's a non-executive of our parent company called the Weems Development Company, and he was production director at Diageo. So through those relationships, we've been okay so far, but I think it is going to be a very real issue for independent bottlers going forward.
Are you able to leverage any of the sales of the barley off your land to get some casks?
Not really. That doesn't help materially. But I think what does help in terms of getting supply is the fact that we are not passing off under a distillery brand name. Because we identify our whiskies by their taste and aroma, I think people that are prepared to supply independent bottlers will more readily supply people like ourselves because, you know, we're not passing off their brand, you know, as a single cask offering or anything like that.
One final question. Which is more fun, the whiskey business or the wine business?
Which is more fun? Well, I think they're both are more fun. They're both fun. I guess the whiskey industry might have more characters in it, people like Charlie McLean. There aren't too many of those sorts of people around the wine industry. So I guess, you know, in terms of characters, the whiskey industry probably has a few more of them. And also the Scotch industry, you know, the Scotch industry is a very small industry, and people are extremely friendly and have been very helpful to us as we've started up our brand from scratch 3 years ago.
There's a link to the Weems Vintage Malts website at the WhiskeyCast website. Finally, this is the last episode before Christmas, and no matter which holiday you celebrate or where you live in the world, I'd like to extend my wishes to you and your family for a happy holiday season on behalf of my family, Christina, Brianna, Arya, and Tessa, and Frizzle the sheepdog. That's all for this episode of WhiskeyCast. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com, and you'll find links, the calendar of events, my whiskey ratings, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.